things early in the game. "Rest assured," they said, "everyone who intends to become financially wealthy will deal with them sooner or later." It suddenly became obvious that these doubts don't go away on their own. Left unexamined or not dealt with, they can keep you from becoming a great investor. We came to understand that these are the myth understandings, part myth and part misunderstanding, that people have about investing. And after some consideration, two distinct categories of myth understandings emerged from the research. The first, your myth understandings about the way you look at yourself as an investor. The second, your myth understandings about the way you look at investing. What we learned was that people generally have two ways of looking at anything: the way they see themselves in the world, and the way they see the world and how it works. You might think it would be reversed, that your perceptions of how the world works would inform your sense of how successful you could be. But for some strange reason, it isn't. The image you have of yourself as an investor becomes the lens through which you see the world of investing. And that self-image will either guide or misguide you. Interestingly, any myths you have about yourself as an investor tend to magnify your misunderstandings about investing. That's why we call the myth understandings about the way you view yourself as an investor the Big Three.
The Big Three myth understandings about the way you look at yourself as an investor. Personal myth number one: I don't need to be an investor. My job will take care of my financial wealth. Personal truth number one: yes, you do need to be an investor. Your job is not your financial wealth.
It's almost epidemic how many people think they don't need to be an investor. Usually that happens because they believe, consciously or unconsciously, that the path to financial wealth is through one's job. If you're like me and believe that financial wealth is about having enough unearned income to finance your life mission without the need to work, chances are your current job income and savings plan won't be nearly enough to build true financial wealth. It's highly unlikely that your job creates enough income for you to set aside a manageable percentage of it, and at an average rate of interest, still achieve true financial wealth. Many years ago, this was a common and encouraged practice that I call the myth of the modest saver. Thrifty individuals would stash small sums of money in coffee cans, under mattresses, and in personal savings accounts, believing they eventually would achieve financial freedom. In more modern times, this modest saver has evolved into the modest investor. This is the person who takes a small percentage of his or her annual income and invests it in his or her company pension plan, a 401k, or a mutual fund. In this time when many people don't save or invest at all, these modest savers and investors are actually ahead of the game, but their investments almost never amount to true financial wealth. All the modest saver of old and the modest investor of today actually build is a small financial nest egg to provide for their most basic needs. When most people stop to do the math, they're shocked at how little income their current investment plan will provide when they quit working. The truth is that only a tiny percentage of people, probably less than 1%, make enough income from their jobs to become financially wealthy. I'm talking about people such as highly paid athletes, actors, musicians, and executives. The extraordinary compensation these people receive is so large that they easily could live off a fraction of their income, invest the rest, and even with modest rates of return, achieve financial wealth. The operative word here is could. I'm continually amazed at how many of these high-income producers think they do not need to be investors. Here's the problem. They cling to a far-fetched assumption that their jobs will continue to provide these extraordinary streams of income. In fact, the more money people make, the more overconfident they tend to be about their financial future. Prosperity can provide a false sense of security. They may overspend and underinvest to the point that one day they wake up and realize they are on the downslope of their primary income earning years and their lifestyle is about to come to an end. Others understand they should be investing, but then delegate all the responsibility for their financial wealth building to other people. As presumptuous as it is to count on your income to always be there, I find it even more presumptuous to trust others to tend your financial future. I don't want to diminish the value of financial advisors. To the contrary, I engage them, have great faith in them, and believe everyone should have them. What I am saying is that wherever your money is, you need to be there too. No matter how you make your money or how much you make, if you don't take an active role in your financial planning and money management, you're at grave risk of seeing your investments underperform, or worse, be lost. As the old saying goes, a fool and his money are soon parted. While we're not calling anyone a fool, not acting like an investor, or not being active in your investments is one of the most financially foolish positions you can take. I encourage you to look at your job differently. Your job is the venue where you can earn your initial investment capital. Then a percentage of your wages must be dedicated to building up your investment stake. I don't want to shock you, but the legendary investor, Sir John Templeton, tells the story of how he and his wife lived off as little as 50% of their income at the beginning of his investment career. They made a game of seeing how well they could live on only a fraction of their household income. While you may not be like Templeton, choosing the path to financial wealth will require that you live off less than you make and consume less than the world tells you to. You can't let the media and advertisers set your values for you. Just as kids sometimes decide what to eat based on television commercials, adults tend to let the media convince them what they should spend their money on if their financial decisions aren't guided by a stronger compass. Don't get caught keeping up with the Joneses. The faster you reach a position where you can begin your investment career, the faster you'll be able to achieve financial independence. I love the story of James Sorensen. In the 1940s, Sorensen had a job selling medical supplies in the Salt Lake City area and got in trouble for not spending enough money on his sales visits with physicians. When he turned in his first expense report for less than $5, his supervisor told him he needed to spend, or at least report, $30 or more for his client entertainment expenses each week, or he'd spoil the business for everyone. But instead of taking doctors out for drinks or fancy meals, Sorensen would buy them a coffee or a soda. Then he'd take the difference and invest it in real estate. In those days, he could buy plots of land in Utah for as little as $25 an acre. About a decade later, the uranium boom hit, and those plots sold for thousands. Rather than just enjoy the perks, Sorensen didn't count on his job for his financial wealth and started small. He spent a lifetime thinking like an investor, working at a job he had a passion for and investing for his future. As a result, by 2004, he was reportedly worth approximately $4 billion. Ideally, you should look at your work this way. It can be a passion that pays you money for doing what you love to do. Some passions pay more than others. But as history indicates, they rarely pay enough to create financial independence. Your job is your job. Financial wealth building is something else. That is how I think Sorensen looked at it, and I encourage you to do the same thing. Most people think that earning money in a job and saving some of it or sticking it in a company retirement plan makes them investors. It doesn't. But they think it does, or think it is close enough that they don't need to be an investor. It is this misunderstanding that causes many people not to become true investors. Don't let that be you. Realize that whatever your job or work is, you also need to be an investor. You must wake up in the morning telling yourself, I am an investor. I'm building financial wealth. Today's the day I could find an opportunity and make a deal.
Personal myth number two. I don't need or want to be financially wealthy. I'm happy with what I have. Personal truth number two. You need to open your eyes. You do need and want to be financially wealthy.
You have no idea what you will need or want beyond today. You cannot predict what life will offer down the road, for good or for bad. As hard as you may try, you can't predict with any confidence the resources you'll need to deal with life's uncertainties. complicating everything is the fact that it takes time to grow money. Financial wealth building is not something that can be accomplished in reaction mode. It's really difficult to find more money just because you suddenly want or need it. As I've said all along, small money comes easily. Big money does not. Becoming an investor, someone who pursues financial wealth building every day, is all about preparing for the minimums and maximums in your life. The unpredictable financial minimums you may need, and the unforeseen financial maximums you may want. If you choose not to pursue financial wealth, more than likely your future will be defined by extremely limiting financial choices. You may have to scramble to meet your changing needs, or do without the things you eventually wish for. At a point in your life when settling for less might devastate you, you might have to do just that. Let me share with you a revealing conversation I had with one of my students on the pursuit of big financial wealth.
You know, I hear you talk about building financial wealth and understand the logic of what you're saying. The problem with that is I'm not motivated by money. I'm happy with what I have. I really don't need or want anything else. Life is going great, just the way it is.
Fair enough. I truly appreciate your honesty and respect your answer. Now I'd like to ask you a question. Do you have insurance? Do you have any car, homeowner, disability, or medical insurance?
Sure. It's the prudent thing to do. Insurance takes care of the unplanned or unexpected, right?
Right. That's exactly the way I feel, too. Things can happen that are beyond your control, and it's good to be prepared. My question for you, though, is this. How can you be sure that the unexpected won't happen in areas of your life that insurance won't cover?
I'm not sure what you mean.
Well, what happens if you suddenly lost your job, or worse, your ability to earn a living?
Honestly, I haven't ever really thought about it. I guess you just don't expect things like that to happen. I have no idea what I'd do in that situation.
I understand. But it is a real possibility. And you really should think about it. And by the way, we're just talking about you. What if that sort of thing were to happen to someone you loved and that person wasn't financially prepared?
You know, that scares me a little bit. The thought that a friend or family member might someday need my help and that I wouldn't be able to provide it makes me sad. If they had health issues or experienced a financial disaster, I think I might feel very bad if I were not in a position to help in a meaningful way.
That's exactly what I'm talking about. If something like that happened and you weren't prepared, at the very least, you might have to make incredible sacrifices in order to be of any help. You're a giving, caring person, and I'd hate to see you in that position. But you're not alone in this. No one can know beyond today what he or she might or might not need in the future. And because that's true, doesn't it make sense to pursue more financial wealth than you currently need? If for no other reason, then financial wealth can serve as an umbrella insurance policy for your life. I gave my student a moment to let the truth of our conversation sink in, and I honestly think it did. Sometimes it's hard to think in terms of future possibilities, especially unpleasant ones. As we talked more, I also let her know that all unanticipated needs aren't bad. What if she had a gifted child who needed special educational opportunities? What if an unforeseen opportunity arose that required more money to take advantage of than she currently had? I wanted to go in this direction because we hadn't yet discussed the other side of the issue, the idea that some needs are also about seizing valuable opportunities to move forward in life, and that sometimes you may want money beyond your current needs and necessities. Here's how the rest of the conversation went. Just for argument's sake, let's imagine that you have all the money you'll ever need. You also have enough to take care of the critical, unforeseen needs that might arise for your friends and loved ones. Now, if you still had an abundance of financial wealth after all those needs had been taken care of, are there other things you might do with your money?
Sure. I guess everyone daydreams about what they'd do if they had a lot of money. My first thought is I'd love to take my parents on a long trip around the world. They've always wanted to travel, but they've never quite been able to. That would make me feel great.
That's awesome. I love the idea of your traveling the globe with your folks. Is there anything else you'd do if money were no object?
Oh, gosh. That's so hard to imagine. I guess maybe I'd help out a friend of mine. She's a single mom, and I know that helping her out a little would be a huge lift for her.
That's great. But now I want you to think even beyond your family and friends. Are there things you'd like to see happen in your community?
I'd fix up the homeless shelter downtown. I'd donate money to provide meals for the needy. I'd set up an after-school recreation program for kids. Actually, we need an emergency blood bank, and I'd fund that too. Honestly, there is so much that is needed right here in town.
Absolutely. I got it. But let's go even bigger than that for a second. What if you had financial wealth such that even after you did all those things, your reach could extend even beyond this town? What could you do?
That's even tougher. Who thinks about that? I mean, I guess I'd do something huge like support cancer research, or maybe I'd want to create an organization to help fund the fight against heart disease. I might even be able to help put a dent in world hunger.
Now listen to yourself. Earlier you said it felt bad to think about pursuing more money. Now it sounds a lot like you're imagining a very exciting life where you're able to make a big difference in the world and in the lives of people.
I've never really thought about it the way we're talking today. I guess I've always been afraid that money might own me.
That's perfectly normal. I think a lot of people feel that way. There's this idea that having more money or pursuing it will change them. Even worse, corrupt them in some way and make them bad people. However, it's been my personal experience that having more money won't change you at all. What it will do is amplify who you already are. I believe that in the end, people are exposed to new possibilities by financial wealth and empowered by it. Instead of being changed by money, it simply allows them to be more of who they really are.
That makes sense to me. More money just makes you more of what you already are.
Exactly. Your hypothetical responses just prove the point. You're one of the most generous souls I know. Having more wealth would just amplify your generosity. So, tell me, how does this new view of your financial potential make you feel?
Honestly, it makes me feel inspired.
Inspired?
Yes, inspired. Inspired that my life could be so much bigger than I ever thought was possible.
You know what? You're inspiring me too. See, this is the kind of thing that happens when you pursue maximums for your financial life instead of minimums. Suddenly, money can become good for the good it can do. And the more you have, the more good you can do. I appreciated the candidness of my student and her willingness to allow me to talk to her in this manner. What's fascinating is that she really did get it. She realized that there are two types of people in the world. First, there are those who, because they chose not to build financial wealth, have limited opportunities to care for themselves and their loved ones. Second, there are those who, because they chose to pursue financial wealth as an investor, have much larger opportunities to care not only for themselves and their loved ones, but also for so much more. It's the difference between a focus on the minimums life can require versus a focus on the maximums life can offer. It comes down to what kind of person you want to be and the life you want to lead. Later, as you might expect, she and I began to talk about how to make more money. This curiosity is the natural result of imagining how big your wants and needs might become. You progress from seeing that it might be possible to believing that it should be. And then you realize that you're now motivated to seek financial wealth to your highest potential. Most people are taught to live within their means, but I was taught differently and encourage you to think differently as well. Instead of forgetting your dreams and living within your means, try pursuing the means to live your dreams.
Personal myth number 3. It doesn't matter if I want or need it. I just can't do it. Personal truth number 3. You can't predict what you can or can't do until you try.
I really struggle with this way of thinking. I just don't understand why people seem to want to place judgment ahead of effort. and unproven opinions before a willingness to try. There's no way for you or anyone else, for that matter, to know your true financial potential. And because your true financial potential is unknown, it makes no sense to place limits on it. "I can't do it" becomes another rationale for not trying, for not stretching, for not exploring your potential. Some people have told me they don't want to set themselves up for disappointment. The unfortunate irony is that the people who would rather not set themselves up for disappointment are the very ones destined for disappointment. The moment you buy into the idea that you can't achieve financial wealth, you put yourself in the path to complacency, compromise, and ultimately regret. Years ago, Monster.com, the online job search company, ran a provocative Super Bowl ad showing a series of children describing their financial dreams and aspirations. The award-winning commercial combined humor with poignancy to make a powerful point about settling for what you thought you could do, instead of pursuing what might be possible. The litany in the commercial went something like this.
"When I grow up, I want to file all day.
When I grow up, I want to climb my way up to middle management.
I want to be replaced on a whim.
I want to be a yes man, a yes woman.
Yes, sir.
Coming, sir.
Anything for a raise, sir."
Three or four other children continued this refrain until the commercial closed with a surprisingly touching question. What did you want to be? With that question, the contrast between the modest aspirations and resigned attitudes of the children in the commercial versus the shoot-for-the-stars hopes real children have went from humorous to sobering. That was when you realized you may have made more compromises along the way than you would have imagined. That somewhere along the journey of your life, you stopped wondering what was possible and started thinking in terms of what was probable. In my experience, there are basically two ways people view their financial potential. There are those who think in terms of what's financially probable, and those who think in terms of what's financially possible. Probability thinkers base their view of their true financial selves on their history and current capabilities. They say to themselves, based on who I've been and who I am, this is probably what I can financially accomplish in the future. They use words such as realistic and likely when they discuss their financial potential. As a result, when they are presented with a new opportunity that doesn't fit their preconceived notions of their financial potential, they often conclude that they simply can't do it. For them, their financial future is determined, predictable, and ultimately static. Possibilities thinkers, in contrast, rarely utter the words, "I can't do it." They set aside any limiting notions they might have about their financial potential and base their view of their future financial selves on what they imagine themselves to be capable of accomplishing. And they use an altogether different vocabulary. Their potential is described in terms of what's conceivable, what's imaginable, what's possible. They say to themselves, "I have dreams for a reason, based on who I can become. This is what I can financially accomplish." They take into account that they might have to learn new things, acquire new skills, or change their habits to reach their full financial potential. For them, their financial future is flexible, active, and ultimately alive. A great example of this is Trammell Crow, who rose from humble beginnings to amass one of the largest real estate empires of all time. A child of the Depression, Crow and his seven brothers and sisters grew up in a Dallas home with no bath or hot water. But Trammell didn't let his modest beginnings dictate the size of his future. In 1948, he went into real estate and saw a world of unlimited possibilities. He quickly realized that through loans and private investors, he could achieve his goals long before he could on his own. Crow's big idea was the commercial shopping mall. We take them for granted now. But in 1955, Crow's idea was revolutionary. By the 1960s, he was the leading developer of shopping malls in the United States. By the 1980s, he was the largest real estate developer and property manager in the country. Today, because he saw no limits to his potential, The Trammell Crow Company is one of the largest diversified commercial real estate services companies in the world. Many of the real estate investors we interviewed told similar stories about how, before becoming investors, they would have been voted least likely to become financially wealthy. A good example is Barbara Mattson, who was mentioned briefly in the introduction. Barbara worked as a home health nurse, and her husband Tom was in construction. They were a typical family, living in a modest home with two cars and a pair of young daughters. Then, in 1997, Tom came home not feeling well. The next morning, he couldn't move. Suddenly, Barbara was left to care for her children and an ailing husband, while also having to earn enough income to cover two car notes, a mortgage, and a mountain of medical bills. Month after month, the Mattsons battled unsuccessfully to get workers' compensation. "I'm living on macaroni and cheese here," she complained to her labor attorney. "I can't do this. You have to help me." But his only response was, "Mrs. Mattson, this is a long process." In her efforts to keep the bills paid and the creditors at bay, Barbara was often just circulating her debt, robbing Peter to pay Paul. In the end, she was encouraged to declare bankruptcy and start over, but she was determined not to give up. In one of those positive coincidences, Barbara bought some tapes on investing in real estate. They were originally intended for Tom, to fill his time and possibly, eventually, provide a way for him to earn income for the family. After all, he worked in construction and understood real estate. But he didn't show much interest, so Barbara listened to the tapes at night while caring for her youngest daughter. She also listened to them on the way to her home care appointments. Then, in July 1998, almost 9 months after he became ill, a simple sneeze caused Tom's legs to go numb. He emerged from surgery cocooned in a body cast. Coincidentally, just when things were darkest, his workers' compensation was approved, and they received a $20,000 check covering 9 months of back payments. Here is one of those defining moments, when the difference between probability thinking and possibility thinking is revealed. Barbara had very little knowledge of investing. In fact, she'd just listened to that single set of tapes. Between work and looking after her husband and family, she had almost no time. Even though she had temporary possession of a large sum of money, her bills and debts added up to a lot more. In essence, she didn't have much money at all. Faced with the same situation, what do you think most people would do with the money? Would they pay off their bills and get their accounts back in order? Would they use the money to supplement their income and get some relief? Or would they do what Barbara did when, in an inspired moment of clarity, she invested the money in real estate? "My philosophy was survival," Barbara said. "If I could start buying real estate and build up enough to replace Tom's income, it wouldn't be so bad if he couldn't ever work again." Over the next 6 months, she started buying rental properties. Eventually, the rents began to add up, until finally she could see light at the end of the tunnel. Today, because she placed no artificial limits on her potential, Barbara owns a real estate company and over $9 million in real estate. Because Barbara could imagine better possibilities and a bigger life, she was able to have them. Be warned, once people step over into possibility thinking and believe that they can achieve financial wealth, they often see a whole new set of obstacles. They quickly become certain that they will need more knowledge than they currently have or could acquire easily. They think things like, "It's too late, I don't have enough time," "There's no way, I just don't have enough money to start investing," or, "I would if I could, but I have no idea what to do, and besides, I'm no good with money." What these individuals don't realize is that most big things start small. They mistakenly believe that big success at anything requires big and mysterious things they don't have. For instance, special natural abilities versus a little of some acquired abilities. Lots of free time versus a little bit of well-spent time, or massive amounts of money versus a little well-placed money. In the end, what you actually need to become a successful investor is a lot less than what you think you need. A careful balance needs to be struck between your ability, your time, and your money in order for you to begin your investment career. While many people mistakenly believe they need a lot of all three, they actually need a little of each three. The right abilities, well-spent time, and well-placed money. Beyond this, they can accelerate their growth as an investor by picking one area to increase. They can choose to focus on acquiring more ability through reading, seminars, or mentors. Giving it more time by seeking opportunities or networking with other investors. Or attracting more money, say from family members, friends, other investors, or lenders. Over time, each of those three areas can grow, and your power as an investor will increase. The hidden secret is that the three factors are multipliers of each other. If you double your time, even if your ability and money remain the same, you double your current investment potential. If you double your ability and your time, you quadruple your current investment potential. If you double each of the three, 2 times 2 times 2 equals 8, you increase your current investment potential eightfold. The investment game is played by beginning with a little of each, then working to increase any one of the three. You can also check the available chart on the bonus CD that illustrates how this multiplier effect works when you increase your investing time, money, and ability, plus a chart to figure your current investment potential, or IP. Your self-assessment in these three areas often dictates your strategy. People who have the luxury of time but have limited financial resources can focus on amplifying their ability to achieve greater success. They also can earn sweat equity by doing much of the work other investors might contract out. In contrast, investors with more financial resources and less time can afford to employ experts and contractors to make up for their lack of time. Time and money are often strongly connected. Time can be used to earn money, and money can be spent to buy time. Similarly, ability can be acquired with time. Think books and seminars. Or ability can be bought with money. Think consultants. Understanding how ability, time, and money combine to produce investment results is an important step on the path to becoming a successful investor. The wonderful thing is this. Any extra ability, time, and money you have in the beginning speeds up the process. When we interviewed best-selling author and millionaire real estate investor Robert Kiyosaki, he made an important observation. People will believe what they want to believe. They find excuses that prevent them from taking a look at what might work. And when they find a reason, they make that reason their reality. He was talking about the power of personal myths and the way they serve as barriers to achievement in our lives. The big three myth understandings are some of the most powerful limiting beliefs you can have. And we hope you are ready to step past them and discover your true financial possibilities. I'm hopeful that you now believe that your job is not your financial wealth, that you both need and want to pursue financial wealth, and that true financial wealth is possible for you, no matter where you are in life. If that is the case, and you have moved past these fundamental doubts and fears, you're ready to address the misunderstandings people commonly hold about investing.
The five myth understandings about the way you look at investing.
Where did you get your earliest thoughts about money and investing? More important, what beliefs do you currently hold, and are they accurate? I'm intrigued by these questions mainly because over the years, I've become convinced that most of the myths and misunderstandings about investing and financial wealth building come from people who've never invested successfully or built financial wealth. Isn't it interesting that so many of us accept and believe the words of others without first verifying that they've earned the right to teach us? In our research on these myths about investing, we went straight to the source. We talked to more than 100 millionaire investors about these very issues. What emerged were five common myth understandings about investing that can cause people to get off track. While these myths certainly apply to investing in real estate, they also transcend it and apply to investing as a whole. They can seep into any discussion about investing. They often are used as justifications for failure, and they're widely repeated in the form of cautionary tales. Investing is complicated, hard to understand, risky, inaccessible, requires perfect timing. They circulate quietly, are taken on faith, and for the most part go unnoticed, which is why we call them the Phantom Five.
Investing myth number one. Investing is complicated. Investing truth number one. Investing is only as complicated as you make it.
Here's the truth. Investing is complicated. But to be fair, almost anything, taken as a whole, can appear more complicated than it really is. Take your car. You don't have to be a mechanic or an engineer to drive it, right? Of course not. All you have to know are the basic rules of the road and how to drive. Investing is no different. The trick is to step back and identify the aspects that matter most. Chris Hake, a millionaire real estate investor in Madison, Wisconsin, started out like most investors, with books, audio cassettes, and seminars. He freely admits that there was more knowledge available than he could digest at once. But instead of being overwhelmed, he found a way to deal with all the new information. "I just treated it like a buffet line. You use what you can. The rest of it may not apply today." I think he's absolutely right. What I've come to understand about learning is that it's always progressive. It builds on itself, step by step. Fractions look like nonsense to a child who has not yet learned about them in school. That's why good teachers start by teaching the basics and then build on them over time. On a practical basis, what I know is that you never need to know everything in order to do something. You just need to know the right things to do at any given moment. Over time, given enough chances to study and experience something, you naturally and progressively will learn everything you need to know to do it well. That is how you become an expert. Real estate investing is no different. When you learn things in the correct order, your knowledge will come more easily and more quickly. One of the core goals of the millionaire real estate investor is to provide the fundamental knowledge you need to get in the game correctly and lay a foundation for success. Like anything else in life, real estate investing is only as hard or as complicated as you make it. As Forrest Gump might say, complicated is as complicated does. Great investing can be learned if you take it slowly. Start with the basics and then follow proven models.
Investing myth number two. The best investments require knowledge most people don't have. Investing truth number two. Your best investments will always be in areas you can or already do understand.
One of the great lessons I've learned about investing is this. Investing in what you don't know or understand isn't investing at all. Doing that is like taking a shot in the dark, and you'll need luck to hit anything worthwhile, much less your intended target. To me, the real nature of investing is always to invest in what you know and fully understand. Choose an area that you already know, or one that greatly interests you. Then commit yourself to becoming an expert over time. I love the story legendary investor Warren Buffett tells about the technology stock boom of the late 90s. Rather than jump on the bandwagon, where thousands of amateurs were amassing small fortunes, Buffett chose to sit out the boom on the sidelines. He admitted that he just didn't know that industry, and without knowledge, he'd essentially be gambling. I love that attitude. Here is an investor who absolutely, no matter what the apparent upside is, sticks to his criteria. Buffett is an amazing investor, and one reason for that is that he invests only in what he knows or can understand. I encourage you to do the same thing. If you don't have specialized knowledge, pick an area and start learning today. I think you'll discover that investing in real estate is one of the easiest areas of investing in which to acquire expert knowledge and understand.
Investing myth number three. Investing is risky. I'll lose my money. Investing truth number three. Investing by definition is not risky.
If you look up invest in the dictionary, this is what you will find. Invest, to commit money or capital in order to gain a financial return. you'll notice that the word risk doesn't appear anywhere in the definition. Why? Because risk is what people bring to the concept of investing. I don't want to sound like a Pollyanna, but the truth is that great investors don't think of investing as risky. For them, it's not about ignoring risk. Instead, it's about following sound investment principles and models. By doing that, they take the risk out of the game. When I say investing, by definition, isn't risky, what I mean is that by investing, you make your money going in. In most cases, this means buying something of value for terms that immediately create a profit for you. Jerry Clevenger, a millionaire real estate investor in Kansas City, Missouri, told us about a deal that perfectly illustrates how investors make their money going in. One evening, a real estate agent called him at 9 o'clock at night and said, "Hey, I've been following this property that's been listed by the bank for $65,000. Well, they just dropped the price to $39,000. Clevenger immediately wrote an offer of $42,000, and his agent faxed it to the owner sight unseen. He felt comfortable making this bold move because he understood what he was buying and what it was really worth. He was right. He quickly sold the house for $54,000 and pocketed the difference. He later told us, "If I hadn't made that offer that night, I wouldn't have acquired the property, because the next day 8 more offers came in." You got to be able to pull the trigger immediately. And to do that, you must know what you're doing. Investing like a millionaire real estate investor isn't about taking risks. It's about having sound criteria, the patience to find the right opportunity, and a willingness to take the correct action quickly. The best investors know this and are dedicated to following this formula. As a result, they are always minimizing their risk while maximizing their return. Investing can never be absolutely risk-free, but it doesn't have to be risky.
Investing myth number 4. Successful investors are able to time the market. Investing truth number 4. In successful investing, the timing finds you.
Timing is everything. But now that you know that, forget it, because you can't truly time anything. Timing is one of the most misunderstood concepts in investing. When people say that timing is important, they are correct. Timing is not only important, it's critical to investment success. The economy is cyclical. Markets are cyclical. And buying and selling opportunities are created by the ebb and flow of the cycles. Finding the best time to buy or sell is called timing. What is misunderstood is the way timing actually is accomplished. Most people think timing is about active observation, sitting on the sidelines, waiting for the moment when they should jump in and take action. It's a passive and then active approach. In other words, timing is about being reactive to opportunity. The truth, however, is that timing is all about being active. Active all the time. I believe that the vast majority of opportunities cannot be observed from the sidelines. You must be in the game. The best deals come from the best opportunities, and the best opportunities go fast. This is where the phrase, a window of opportunity, comes from. Investors recognize and seize these opportunities because they are always engaged in the game and close to the action. Dykes Bodiford, a millionaire real estate investor from Marietta, Georgia, was watchful and engaged when he noticed that the day before a foreclosure sale, a bank had lowered its opening bid on a property by more than $100,000. He knew this because rather than taking the foreclosure information at face value, he called the bank to learn more about the property. Armed with that knowledge, he and a partner purchased the house at auction, put it back on the market, priced to sell, then 90 days later made over $100,000 from the transaction. In retrospect, someone might say that Bodiford was lucky or had great timing. But Bodiford wasn't timing the foreclosure market. He was there every day, watchful for opportunity and ready to act on it when it arose. If you pursue opportunity in this way, you too can look like a timing genius. In fly fishing, they say, you can't catch a fish with your hook in the air. That's also true of timing the market. Successful timing is made possible by time spent on the task over time. You have to keep your hook in the water. Being active and engaged doesn't mean you're always buying and selling. What it does mean is that you are consistently searching with your criteria, watchful for the moment when opportunity surfaces. This is what I mean when I say that timing finds you. You can never know the absolute best time to act, except after the fact. Hindsight is, as they say, 20/20. Better to look at it like this. Anytime an opportunity meets your strict criteria and you act, you have timed the market successfully. Timing isn't about being in the right place at the right time. It's about being in the right place all the time.
Investing myth number 5. All the good investments are taken. Investing truth number 5. Every market and every time has its share of good investments.
Rest assured, all the good investments will be taken. The only question is by whom? As simple as it sounds, the truth is that those who take them are those who best understand the conditions that create them. By the way, this is the other and more subtle side of the timing issue. While the previously discussed myth was about timing the market, this myth addresses your timing as an investor. A lot of people say to me, "Okay, now that I've decided to become an investor, where are all the deals? It seems like the few opportunities I've been able to find are already taken." I understand what they're saying. And there are really two issues at work here. First, the idea that there aren't many deals. Second, the idea that you're too late to get them. Here's what I know about market forces and how they create investment opportunities. There are two fundamental forces at work, economic ones and personal ones. They are always present, always at work, and always influencing the marketplace. Basic economic forces show up in the form of things such as job growth, interest rates, population shifts, and area revitalization. These are the things most people think of when they think of forces that create investment opportunities. What is often overlooked, however, is a second set of human or personal forces that are always present and can create additional and significant investment opportunities. Some arise from positive circumstances, such as relocation, marriage, and family growth. Others arise from negative conditions, such as divorce, death, and debt. In my experience, those who declare that all the good deals are taken are almost always overlooking this second set of human forces and the unique opportunities they create. What I most want you to understand is that opportunities are always there in every market and in every time. Some opportunities are the result of obvious economic forces. Others are the result of local and incidental personal forces. And you're never too late, because personal forces are always at work. These opportunities are constantly being created. While yesterday's deals have indeed been taken, tomorrow's deals have not. Nor are they destined to go automatically to someone else. But in time, they will be taken by someone, and I want you to realize that that someone could be you. It's really a game of hide and seek. And if you choose, you are now it and must seek. The opportunities are gone only for those who assume they are. You're too late only if you believe you're too late.
The Law of Momentum, Compounding Your Success.
In closing, let me encourage you to believe that everything big starts small. When most people consider investing for the first time, it's not uncommon for them to think that it will take forever for their investments to amount to anything. When they consider their first investment, most people find it difficult to justify the time, money, and effort for the returns they can see. It can seem like madness to look so hard for a rental property that may only yield a couple of $100 a month. These short-term benefits just don't seem to balance out the short-term sacrifices. I strongly encourage you to step past that short-term thinking and look at the larger implications of small investments. What must be understood is that there is a natural growth curve to momentum. Think of a ball rolling downhill that picks up mass and speed as it goes. It's what we commonly call the snowball effect. Although it may start out small or slow, it ends up growing quite big and fast. In the same way, money, once invested, has its own momentum. The technical name for that is compounding. What starts small and grows slowly builds in size and momentum over time. My son discovered the power of compounding one Saturday afternoon when we were weeding the flower beds at our home. As we worked, we were listening to an audio tape about money and life I'd been listening to before he joined me. We were going along fine until I looked up and found myself alone in the backyard. My first thought was that he'd gone in for water and gotten sidetracked. When I went in to look for him, I found him at the kitchen counter adding up a series of numbers on a piece of paper. He was trying to disprove a story he'd just heard and couldn't believe. It was the classic story of the value of a penny doubled every day for 30 days that is often used to illustrate the idea of compound interest. In short, a worker is offered a reasonable daily wage for a month's work. Instead of taking the normal pay, the worker negotiates a compounding pay scale where his pay doubles every day but starts with just a penny. The employer quickly shakes on the agreement, thinking she's getting a great deal. Unfortunately for her, as the story later illustrates, the 30 days of doubled pay that began with a single penny ended with a total invoice of $10.7 million. I walked John through the numbers and assured him that the numbers told the truth. This led to a great discussion of money and rates of return. Any form of investing is about putting your money to work and letting it work for you over time. Real estate investing is no different. What distinguishes it from other investments is that the original value of your asset tends to be large and, through the magic of leverage, can be purchased for less. For example, if you bought a $100,000 investment house each year, by putting $10,000 down and achieved only a modest 5% rate of return on the total value of the assets, you'd be a millionaire in less than a decade. With each asset you add to your portfolio grows. As your investments grow, so does your buying power and your investment knowledge. That's the foundation for bigger and ever-increasing investments. No matter what your current station in life is, financial wealth is available to you. No matter how little money or knowledge you have in the beginning, a great ending is possible for you. The trick is to get started, and then let the power of growth on growth take you higher. The longest journeys are just an accumulation of small steps. The tallest buildings are built by placing block upon block. If you're ready to take the next step on your journey to financial wealth, if you believe that it is both possible and probable for you, it's time to leave your misunderstandings behind. Keep listening and begin thinking like a millionaire real estate investor.
The Millionaire Real Estate Investor, Part 2. The Four Stages. First, think a million. The spiritual journey of wealth building.
It's my belief that the pursuit of money is actually a spiritual journey. That's a statement most people wouldn't agree with. In fact, they might even argue against it. Yet I know it's true. Would it surprise you to learn that the Bible has over 2,000 references to money, property, and wealth? That's more than twice the number of references to faith and prayer combined. In fact, money shows up as a prominent theme in every major religious text. No matter what your personal faith is, spirituality and money are always connected. It seems that God cares about how you think about money and wealth. And that makes perfect sense to me. Money, what you do to acquire it, how you hold on to it, and what you do with it, reflects your innermost values. What you may not realize is that every time you open your wallet, endorse a check, or sign a credit card receipt, you're making a statement about your spiritual values. In other words, money spent is a personal testament. The receipts are absolute proof of your priorities. Money, in and of itself, is neither good nor bad. It simply has the power to reflect and reveal. And whether money reveals you to be honest or dishonest, generous or greedy, it's you, not the money, who inherently own those values. I've come to think of money as being about having choices. Typically, the more money you have, the more positive choices you have. The two go hand in hand. The spiritual journey of financial wealth builders begins when they understand that their choices define their lives, that having more positive choices is a good thing, and that pursuing more positive choices is an enlightened path. The millionaire investors we interviewed understood this and had taken care to square their financial goals with their spiritual values. While most set out on the path to financial security and prosperity, they all came to understand that the way they earned their money mattered, and that mutually beneficial deals, a reputation for honesty and fair dealing, were essential to the fulfilling purpose of their financial goals. The further they progressed, the more generous they tended to be with their time, money, and financial wisdom. They talked about the satisfaction they received, not only from successful deals, but also from saving people from foreclosure, putting people in affordable homes, turning downtrodden properties, even whole neighborhoods, into places where anyone would want to live. They also related how the success of their personal investing had created income and opportunity for their colleagues and partners. To sum it up, they had no hang-ups about money or wealth. They were experiencing the power of money and realizing all the good it could do. Over the years, I too have come to understand that money is good for the good it can do. I encourage you to adopt that viewpoint as well, that money is good for the good it can do for you and the good it can do for others. Financial wealth building is also about personal growth. Along the way, you'll discover that you have to acquire new skills and greater wisdom to keep moving forward. The simple truth is that if you don't grow personally with the growth of your fortunes, you're unlikely to enjoy them for long. In the end, you can achieve a financial place of security and abundance that I call true financial wealth. It's where you have accumulated assets that deliver the passive income necessary to achieve your personal mission in life without having to work. To put it another way, you have financial wealth when you're finally free to stop working for a living and start living for your work, your life's work. In the following pages, we take a deeper look at some of the ways millionaire real estate investors think about money, their motivation for seeking financial wealth, and their understanding of how it's attained. If you can tap into their mindset and grasp the fundamental principles of how to build, hold, and employ wealth, you'll have achieved the first major goal of this book, thinking like a millionaire real estate investor.
The 7 ways millionaire real estate investors think.
Thinking is thinking. It takes just as much time and energy to think small as it does to think big. The only difference lies in the results you get. Most people don't truly realize this, and as a result, don't consciously choose the way they think. The Millionaire Mountain logo on the cover of this book is meant to symbolize the power of thinking big. It comes from a discussion of climbing Mount Everest I sometimes use to illustrate the path of high achievement, going after big, audacious goals. People who set out to test the slopes of Mount Everest don't do so on a whim. It's a big goal, and it requires big thinking. They study, plan, and think strategically. Months, even years of preparation are involved because there's a lot at stake. One major misstep can result in falling short of the summit or even in disaster. There's just as much at stake in your financial life, and becoming financially wealthy represents an Everest of sorts in the world of money. The journey is big and can be long, sometimes trying. Often it's extremely difficult, but it is always worthwhile, always. The best way to prepare for a climb to the highest altitude is first to acquire the right mindset and attitude. It's even been said that your attitude determines your altitude. That's why a substantial section of this book is dedicated to the way you think. It's about building sound financial thinking as a foundation for building solid financial wealth, enriching your mind, and enriching your life. Consider this chapter, Think a Million, as your financial base camp on the path to climbing the millionaire mountain. It's a place where even the most competent and confident climbers must pause and listen to the wisdom of those who have reached the summit before them. It's time to examine the 7 ways millionaire real estate investors think.
Number 1. Think powered by a big why.
In Think and Grow Rich, Napoleon Hill wrote, "What a different story men would have to tell if only they would adopt a definite purpose and stand by that purpose until it had time to become an all-consuming obsession." Motivation matters. Napoleon Hill believed it. And so do I. In fact, this is something I learned a long time ago, and ever since I've made it my practice to study the lives of successful people to discover their motivation to achieve. I clip news articles, read biographies, and watch documentaries on their lives. What I try to decipher from their individual stories is a common pattern for achievement. What did these people do differently? Were they smarter or better educated? Did they come from high-achieving families? Were they exceptionally gifted or hard-working? The primary characteristic I've found in the lives of high achievers is that they had a strong drive to succeed. They had a compelling, personal reason to achieve. It's what I call a big why. One of the many articles I clipped was from a management study in which the authors made an interesting discovery. When tested against such factors as intelligence, ability, and salary, it's the level of motivation that proves to be a more significant element in predicting career success. The authors went on to state that while the level of motivation was strongly correlated to individual success, it didn't matter where the motivation came from. In general, I've found this to be true as long as the motivation is powerful and lasting. The millionaire real estate investors we spoke to while researching this book shared with us the fact that their motivation arose from a desire to be free from their jobs, have more choices in their lives, achieve self-actualization, and gain the security that comes with abundance. They shared a similar drive to reach for their potential, asking questions like, "How much am I capable of?" and "What's possible for me?" High achievers, the millionaire real estate investors, are powered by a big why. Striving to be your very best will have you following in their footsteps on the path to big success. A big why can redefine your life in ways you might not have imagined. But to qualify as a big why, your motivation should move you from thinking in terms of electives